So these are some of the stories that I think you should probably know about today. So there's this video of refugees being killed by drones as they try and escape from the war-torn area of Kupiansk as Russian forces take the town. Look, I gotta tell you, this is gonna be hard to watch. Nuclear showdown of strength, a most dangerous game is on between the United States and Russia as the U.S. fires off an ICBM missile and Russia response. And then there's this crazy moment again.
Right. Hold on.
So what happened in the Holocaust
and all the pogroms, were disgusting.
Just like
that doesn't mean that Israel...
You are not going to believe what was said to Cenk Uygur on the Piers Morgan show. We're going to give it the Sanchez effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. Things are really starting to break in Ukraine, right? Experts are saying this thing is over. Is that really the case, though? You know what we're going to do for you? Because I think this is the best way to do it. We're going to pull out a bunch of maps of the battlefield and check in as we're showing those maps with one of the foremost military experts, Andrei Martyanov. So he can tell us if what we're hearing from all these other experts and all these other news reports is actually fiction or fact in places like Pokrovsk and Mirnorod and Radinsky. But we're going to begin in a different place. We're going to begin in a town a little further north where, according to credible reports by Western military institutes, the Russian military is knocking on the door and about to go in and about to take over. That town is called Kupiansk. You see it right there on the map in relation to Pokrovsk, right? It's much further north. So what is happening there is absolutely heart-wrenching. All right, let me take you through it. But first, let me tell you something. What you're about to see is very graphic. And we've tried to take out some of the most gruesome parts, but you're still going to witness what is the new reality of war, which is a moment of death by drone. Here it is. Okay, this is the first video. This woman, like many others, is trying to evacuate the town and head toward where Russian military is so she can avoid the fighting and the Ukraine side. By all accounts, she's a Russian speaker, like many of the people who live there. But on the way, she encounters a drone. She's an old woman, but she's sophisticated enough to know what a drone can do. So she gets on her knees and she begins to pray and cross herself, hoping and praying that this Ukrainian drone operator who is looking at her will spare her life. He doesn't. Here's another one. This is a man also trying to evacuate. He's with his dog and he's waving a white flag to signal to the operator that he's, pardon me, not a combatant who's looking at him. Unfortunately for him and his pet, it doesn't work. He's not spared. Instead, as he picks up his dog and tries to protect both, are killed instantly by the drone. Look, I know this is tough to watch, but let me say this, right? Some would say we probably shouldn't show stuff like this. But you know what? I've been practicing journalism now for more than four decades, and I truly believe that when I share something like this and you see it for yourself, not me describing it for you, saying, oh, I saw it, I'll tell you what it showed, but rather you actually seeing it, experiencing it, that's when you can truly capture it. And that, more importantly, is when you can form your own opinion. And that's why the world has now turned on Israel, for example, because they don't control the narrative anymore. Because people all over the world have seen with their own video, with their own eyes, they've seen what's happening in Gaza for themselves. Thanks to TikTok and thanks to other social sites, instead of what happened in the past where it was filtered by media outlets and controlled for you by, you guessed it, entities like Israel and others, powerful forces in the West. See, that's the difference. And that's why we here on the Sanchez Effect thought about this and decided that, no, we wanted you to see this. Now I want to talk about the other big story. Last night, the United States fired off an intercontinental missile from California to the Marshall Islands in the Pacific. This is what it looked like. This photo was provided by the Trump administration. in order to show off its U.S. nuclear capabilities. Of course, it wasn't an actual nuclear test because no warhead was involved, but it did test the speed and the range of this famously called Minuteman III missile, which traveled 4,200 miles and is also referred to as an ICBM, short for Intercontinental Ballistic Missile. Of course, the real reason for this show of force was to send a message to the Russians about the U.S.'s nuclear strength. Look, this is a little bit of a precarious tit-for-tat that's taking place right now between these two nuclear superpowers, the Russians and the Americans, which is why soon after that, the Russians then choreographed their own little show of strength. Watch.
The actions clearly indicate Washington's active buildup of strategic offensive weapons. The United States Army is planning to adopt a new medium-range Dark Eagle missile system with hypersonic missiles with a range of 5,500 kilometers at the end of this year. In the future, it is planned to deploy this complex in Europe and the Asian Pacific region. It follows from this that we must maintain our nuclear potential in readiness to inflict unacceptable damage on the enemy in any circumstances, and act appropriately in response to Washington's steps in the interests of ensuring the security of our country. In view of the above, I consider it advisable to begin preparations for full-scale nuclear tests immediately.
So that's a meeting, President Putin. You saw him there last night, meeting. Those are his top military commanders. And he's ordering them to resume full-scale nuclear tests in Russia at Russia's Novaya Zemlya site. Now, here's the real question here that we should ask, right? Who started this thing, right? Who started this most recent and somewhat concerning mine is bigger than yours contest between the Russians and the Americans? Let's consider it. Let's look back a little bit, right? Let me take you through it. So the Russians would say it's the U.S., going back to the Biden presidency. When every day they were constantly threatening Russia of giving long-range missiles to Kiev so that they could use them against Russia. We were thinking they might possibly fire one against Moscow or St. Petersburg, and that's why we started talking like this. The Trump administration would say no, or yet. They would say it began for them when the Russians recently, in October, right, introduced this baby. That is the Burevestnik missile. Burevestnik missile. It is a nuclear-powered cruise missile that the Russians developed and have just recently unveiled. We're told there's nothing like this thing. I mean, because while the Minuteman, for example, that I just showed you, and other missiles can go some 4,000 to 5,000 miles, this thing can stay in the air almost indefinitely. At worst, they say 14 hours flying in the air because it's propelled by nuclear power. So here's the real story. Russia's military, in some ways, because of the war in Ukraine, has developed, used, and a lot of people are saying perfected some of the most advanced weapon systems that now exist in the entire world. What with glide missiles, drone technology, as well as the enviable battlefield strategy, which is the reason that NATO hasn't been able to defeat them in this proxy war that they're having in Ukraine. And you know what? Most experts are saying, I heard them this morning and I read them this morning, that they probably can't and they probably won't. But we're going to wait, and we're going to confirm that with Andre in just a little bit to see if Andre Martynyov is going to join us to see if we can confirm that in just a couple of minutes. Let's move now to energy sources, because there's something that Vladimir Putin also announced that got my attention when I heard him say it. You know how Russia is known for having perhaps more hydrocarbons, oil and gas, than just about any country in the entire world? Meanwhile, China has more rare earth minerals than any country in the world. One fuels combustible engines, as you know, and the other one fuels batteries for phones and electric vehicles, as I'm sure you know. It's the new hot technology, right? Well, China has 44 million metric tons of rare earth minerals. Brazil has 21 million. India comes in at number 3 with 6.9 million. Australia has 5.7 million. And then Russia is said to have 3.8 million. But wait, Here's a change. According to a report from a Russian Ministry of Natural Resources, Russia has just announced it actually has 28.5 million metric tons of rare earth minerals, putting it, as you can see on the list, right under China. They're not number five. They're number two in the world when it comes to rare earth mineral reserves. And you know what? If you think about it, it kind of makes sense, doesn't it? That the largest country in the world would have deposits of rare earth minerals, most likely under what was the what were the polar ice caps, but it didn't even know it was there, but will now, on orders from the president last night, develop and extract it. This is a new priority for Russia, and it fits the strategy, its strategy, to try and become more sanction-proof and less reliant on the West. Finally, there's this. Another night, another crazy screaming match about Gaza on the Piers Morgan show, which has become, well, kind of, you know, it's fun to watch. I got to tell you, I'm addicted. I watch it from time to time. But frankly, it's also a little bit over the top, you know, the screaming matches and stuff. But this time, my friend Cenk Uygur was on there, so I turned up the volume, and I watched him argue it out with Katie Miller, who, like her husband, who works in the Trump administration, is an ardent Zionist, very anti-immigrant. Here's a taste.
I'm really sick and tired of this racist, bigoted rhetoric that comes from people like you against my husband, against my family, and my children. I am raising Jewish children in this country.
Who brought your children into this? What a weirdo.
Piers, I'm going to be done with this if you're going to allow racist and bigoted attacks against one of your commentators just for the sake that he will not
let me speak. Casey, to be clear.
He inserted a line that says the Miller's lie. Is that not coded language for therefore we are Jewish? Come on, Piers. Where are you?
What?
Where are you standing?
God, you're so
Casey,
pathetic.
if I can speak.
Everything's your shield.
If I can speak, listen.
Fire him, cancel him, America. Oh, my God, Israel's feelings have been hurt. Why don't you work for this
All
country?
Can we try and get...
This country.
Yeah, you are a guest on my show, and I appreciate you coming on the show, and I like you coming on the show.
And I'm saying, you know, two other guests are welcome to participate in these anti-Semitic attacks that is so permeating on CNN and MSNBC.
This is so ridiculous. I'm sorry. I have to jump in here. Somebody criticizing you personally is not an anti-Semitic attack. If somebody says that you are lying, that is not an attack on Jews. That is an attack on you.
Yeah, kind of every night. But then things got really crazy and out of whack. Remember, her husband works in the Trump administration, which is why what she says next about Cenk is kind of scary.
Right. Hold on.
So what happened in the Holocaust
and all the pogroms, were disgusting.
Just like
that doesn't mean that is.
I don't know if you caught it there at the end. What he said, what she said, right? But it's a lot of people are talking about this right now in the United States because you just don't do that. Now Cenk can be a little over the top sometimes. He's very loud, but he's also, as I said, a friend of mine. He's an experienced journalist, a real journalist, who happens to have been born in Turkey. But he's as an American as anybody else out there, very smart. And she just told him, an American, that he has to check his papers because she might make sure that he gets deported out of the country. Look, I got to tell you, that is so wrong, so crazy that I thought I would point it out because it's emblematic of what's happening right now in America, what's happening in my country right now. It is as divisive, as loud, and as angry as I have ever seen it. It is. Anyway, when we come back, as promised, we're going to try and break down what's really happening across the front line in the Ukraine war with a true expert on Russian military and naval strategy. Andrei Martyunov is going to join us right here. Again, he's as good as they come when it comes to understanding what's actually happening right now in Ukraine, and someone who can objectively explain it to us. So stay right there, because this is what we're going to go through when we come back. Stay with us. And I want to welcome you back as we're getting ready to talk to our expert. Andrei Martyunov is probably as good as it gets. We knew eventually this week. Everybody's been focusing on what's happening in Ukraine because there's been a lot going on in Ukraine. So We wanted on this day to dedicate this part of the show to trying to break down in ways that only a military expert can do it what's happening right now in many of those key places. We mentioned Kupiansk and obviously the area around Pokrovsk as well. So let me tell you a little bit about Andrei. He was born in Baku, USSR, 1963, graduated from the Kirov Naval Red Banner Academy, served as an officer in ships and staff position in the Soviet Coast Guard through 1990. In the mid-90s, he moved to the United States, where he worked as a laboratory director in the Commercial Aerospace Group. Today, I see him all the time. It's like you can't turn on your TV and not see him being interviewed by one of these guys on who has some of the most famous podcasts in the world. They all turn to him to find out, to get a better understanding of what's happening right now, objectively, with the situation between Ukraine and Russia. And we are good enough, and he is good enough to give us his time, and we welcome him. Andrei, thank you so much for joining us, sir.
It's a pleasure.
I think we should start off talking about this situation in Kupiansk because, you know, we made the decision. We wanted people to see this because it's the reality of drone warfare and the reality of what's happening right now between Ukraine and Russia. And look, horrible things happen in wars. That's just the reality of what a war is. But this looks particularly cruel, especially given the age of some of these people who obviously are not combatants and they're just trying to get the hell out of there. There's also an argument as to, is this really the Ukrainians doing this? Because the Ukrainians are now trying to put out a report saying it's the Russians. Can you help us understand this a little better, sir?
Yeah, it's traditional modus. Well, it's modus operandi by the NATO curators and their essentially people whom they control, which are armed forces of Ukraine, and which today already about half of it are all kinds of the volunteers and all kinds of the Western, soldiers of fortune, if you wish. Mm-hmm. So if not half, probably around 40% at the front line because the losses are huge. So it's normal, starting from the famous provocation in Bucha, where obviously all proper Western journalists have been ready to go there and see what those Russians did. You know, I'm being facetious, of course. Mm. It was all false flag. It's a classic modus operandi of MI6 and CIA. That's the only thing they are good at. And they continue to do this. And don't forget that for the majority of the people in Kyiv, which is Nazi regime, and for the majority people in London or Washington, D.C., who run this thing, those are dirty Russian Slavs, subhumans, you know, so it's they have to die. This is the prevailing mood and prevailing thinking among majority of the armed forces of Ukraine, whatever is left there. So they are very well brainwashed and, you know, prepped for essentially a repetition of the, how to put it politely, It's very reminiscent of what Wehrmacht and SS did on the territory of the Soviet Union in the World War II. So it's as tragic as it is, there's nothing, absolutely nothing surprising about it.
Huh. So you're saying stuff like this happens all the time, it's just that either there's no video of it or it just doesn't get coverage by the mainstream press and media, because if Russia did this, it would make headlines. But when Ukraine does it, it doesn't make headlines.
No. I mean, average Western journal from the mainstream legacy media is a war criminal. It's a Gibsonian propaganda machine. Those people have no integrity, humanity won't have you in them. So it's just inevitable degeneration, a decomposition of the media world, primarily around, you know, primarily in the West, albeit many other places have this issue. So for them, you know, the more those them Ruskis die, the better, you know. Hmm. So it doesn't matter, children, old people. Just yesterday, Russian Defense Ministry returned after proper whatever the medical procedures there, and remnants of the 300 civilians from Kursk Adventure of NATO, essentially. And those remnants, those people have been women have been raped, children have been mass executed. So it's normal thing for them. And that is why, as I already stated, Western media are media of the war criminals. Essentially, they are complicit in pushing what is happening still today, albeit obviously when the fortunes, well, they always have been not in favor of Ukraine. It's just that the political top and media which serve them, they don't have professional understanding of what is going on. So, but other than that, that is why, I mean, there is no difference between Goebbelsonian propagandist and average BBC or New York Times journal. So that's what it is.
You know, I'm listening to you, and I listen to you all the time. I enjoy your commentary. I was watching you, I think, with Mr. Davis and Mr. Napolitano and just recently. And I get a feeling listening to you now that after watching this video, you're kind of mad about this. Like this is really kind of angering you to watch this video. Am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely correct. I mean, this is a pure simple SS, you know? Just that's what they do. Civilians. They are not good fighting militarily in terms of especially issues of the operation planning and strategy and how it is implemented. But they are very good at what they do. False flag, attacking civilian targets, as I already stated, in Suja, around Suja, for example, during the Kursk, basically attack on Kursk, where they lost 80,000 people, well, I couldn't call them people, rape was normal. And you know what, a number of villages, people were mass executed. Children with women have been locked in their basements, and they had their, you know what, tripwires that if they go out and open the door, the grenade will explode. And so that's what they do. I mean, they executed 14 children. So, I mean, how can I not be mad? But at this point, it's not just I'm not just mad. I mean, I already stated my position, which has been confirmed since the very inception of not just special military operation, but through, when I started my blog in 2014, that together with those war criminals like Kagan clan, you know, the Victoria Nuland, people who actually, you know, helped to unleash this, and all kinds of Bidens and, you know, people of this nature, there is no difference. You can take a look at Gaza, for example. Yeah. The only combined West is good at militarily is to fight civilians, period. So, and that's my first book, which was written 8 years ago, speaks about it.
Yeah.
So,
no, I forgot to mention that, by the way, that you're a well-known author and as well as a naval and military expert. I was talking to Glenn Deason 2 days ago, and he mentioned the same thing you just did. He told me, and I think he's quite right about this, and it was proven by all of a sudden Mr. Zelensky's showing up saying that he's meeting with troops, and it was the headline in the BBC and in other Western papers. Yep. Like, that's the biggest story, really? That the Ukrainians really, really are good. Who else? Larry Johnson said this morning, too. He said, you got to give the United States and the Ukrainians credit. They are really good at the PR and marketing stuff, much better than the Russians. The Russians are good fighters, but they don't know how to sell it. And the Ukrainians take every opportunity to create a new headline for themselves.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I mean, it's not just Ukrainians. Do not forget, people like average staff on BBC, you know, or, you know, what is Mr. Rosenberg is the guy in BBC in Moscow. The guy lies through the teeth. You probably can remember a couple of years ago, Mr. Lavrov, when answering to one of the representatives of your former organization, CNN, he stated, I'm not going to answer a question. Write whatever you want. You're going to lie anyway. So this is what they do. Mm-hmm. And when I say that they are war criminals, they are. They are responsible. They have their hands in blood of innocent civilians. And yeah, they also cover up the atrocities, for example, which have been committed against Russian POWs, as few of them have been taken prisoners. And I'm not going to be describing in detail what have been done to those people. So some SS people, and you know, it's like from the anecdote when the guy had been thrown out of Gestapo for cruelty, you know. So, and it's just same thing. And when I state that they are war criminals, I mean it. It's not exaggeration. It's not figure of speech. Most of those people have to be behind bars because they are the ones who help to perpetuate what is happening in the West. But then again, you have to look at who owns them. Most of them are prostitutes, literally and figuratively speaking. And so in this case, what can I say? You have to look at the political top, which, well, due to their vile nature and basically incompetence, they unleashed this hell. And now they're beginning to squeal because obviously even morons in, let's say, British Parliament or in Trump administration begin to understand what is unfolding. Although they have been warned, I've been warning them for the second decade now. I wrote, you can go back to my inception of my blog more than 10 years ago when I said they don't understand what they got themselves into. They already lost. They just don't know it yet. Hmm. So now when they have their best proxy, and this is the best proxy after Hitler and Wehrmacht, you know, and Axis, what the combined West had against Russia, when they see it decimated, well, not decimated, more than that, I mean, and what do they do? They begin to, coping. They begin to, again, try to shape narrative. But you cannot constantly just live in this, you know, echo chamber and delusional world. It's at some point of time, the facts, which only matter, begin to take charge. And this is what we're observing right now. They are in panic. They are desperate. And they will cover up any atrocity. The more they have Ruskis killed, the better. You know, as already stated, the average guy from New York Times or Washington Post, they enjoy it. I mean, instead of looking at Russian civilians being killed and think there are no people of honor there or integrity.
So I heard Johnson say this last night. I heard McGregor. I heard Jeffrey Sachs say it. Who else? Oh, I heard Danny Davis say this. It seems like almost everyone out there who has legitimately followed this is saying the war is over or something very similar to that. Are they right?
Yeah.
Are they right?
Yeah, it is over. It was actually the problem was what I call the arrangement phase. The arrangement phase started in the after famous so-called counteroffensive in 2023 when 200,000 of those people who have been sent to their death by none other than American generals who planned this and they had the operational control of the armed forces of Ukraine have been absolutely wiped out. I mean, and since then it was all just arrangement phase. It's like, you know what, tightening the wires, you know, you tighten them more and more until they kind of get the message. They couldn't get the message, especially when you look at, for example, what we had in the White House in terms of Biden administration and fanatics, basically, who were ready to go to the World War III. I mean, and Russians had to tread carefully because it's a responsibility for the whole of humanity. And when you had the people like Blinkens or Sullivans, they're totally incompetent, uneducated creeps, basically, you know, Blinken should have stayed with this, you know, personal injury, whatever, the lawyer in New York or what have you. So we have a little bit of improvement, narcissist and, you know, kind of the guy who, like, in Trump, but at least he's not eager to start World War III in nuclear exchange. And so that's what Russia has to deal with because the trends on the collapse of the West, so to speak, have been profound already by after 2008, you could see essentially where it was all going. So how do you, and the rat, cornered rat, everybody knows it could be dangerous. It could be go and do, as Israeli calls, some sort of option, you know, just, oh, you know, if we die, let everybody die around it. And there are plenty of people in Washington, D.C., who have this, you know, especially in terms of the evangelical fundamentalists and Christian Zionists who still looking for second coming of Jesus Christ or whatever they're looking for, you know. So because, hey, well, let's kind of, you know, speed this thing along the way and blow the whole world around us. These are fanatics and they constitute primarily the, apart from the corruptioners who are infesting the Capitol Hill. So these are the type of people you have to deal with because you cannot smack them immediately with the hammer on the head. They might get really upset. So you have to do it slowly. But in the end, we have now more than 2 million of Ukrainian forces killed, together with all kinds of killed alone. So you multiply it by two, another 4 million PTSD wounded, so people who are not in their normal state. So there you go. That's the result. Hmm. They have their hands, you know, not that armed forces of Ukraine deserve any different treatment, but, I mean, they threw those people, that cannon fodder, because for them, Ukrainians also subhumans. They, you know, just let them expand, you know. And that's what we have now.
Let's take this through the different places where the confrontations, the military confrontations, are taking place right now. If we have a map, let's start with Kupiansk. Kupiansk, of course, is where I just showed those videos of those elderly people being killed while they were trying to leave the town. You see it up there. It's very much north of where the big action is taking place, which is Pokrovsk. Tell us what's happening in Kupiansk. I read this morning in the Military Institute of War map report that Kupiansk is almost taken by the Russians. They're knocking on the door. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, it is true, and it's more than that. I mean, there are remnants of, there was, I believe, 7 brigades. But then again, you have to remember that today, Ukrainian Forces Brigade is not traditional brigade in how it is known, for example, in the United States or in Russia, which is between 4,500 and 5,500 people. Mm-hmm. They are down to basically 2,000. What have you. But so you have about 7,500-8,000 people trapped there, or whatever is left of them. And so they have been concentrated or pushed towards the southern end of Kupiansk. They are surrounded. There is no exit there other than trying to get out on foot in all those small groups. They use very many civilians as the human shield. That's what they do. Mm. They also hide in the civilian houses. That's their modus operandi. And so as a result, Russians have to tread this also cautiously, because obviously there are still some civilians left in Kupiansk. And as a result, we have now the situation of the what is called reduction of the cauldron. Well, it's kind of, medical term, if you wish, but in reality, they're just killing them there, and they constantly, you know, offer to surrender. Most of the time, they do not want to surrender. They are brainwashed into the believing that Russians going to kill them anyway.
Those Ukrainian forces that are in there in Kupiansk, for example, before we move on to Mirnorod and Rodinsky and Pokrovsk, will they be able to get out of there, or are they? No. Did I hear you say trapped?
No, I mean, they may try, as I already stated. There are no roads, as is the case, for example, with Pokrovsk, which are not controlled by Russians. So you can take a look at, actually yesterday in my video I showed, there is a column of more than squad, I would say 12, 13, half a platoon, essentially, of Ukrainians trying to escape on foot in the forest, strips of the forest, which still are there. Well, they are detected naturally, and then artillery begins to work, and that's it. So,
there it is. There's that video. Yeah, describe to us what's happening here.
Oh, no, they're just trying to escape. So they trying to escape on the foot. They go into their, as you can see yourself, those are what is called forest strips, which separate those fields. And they're essentially windbreakers, you know. So, and this is primarily where they hide, especially for the last year. And you have to constantly identify their, for example, strong points, what is in there. Then, of course, either drones come in, but primarily the job done is by artillery and other long-range fires. Which is called the ROC, which is a Recon Fire Complex. And the fate of these guys, they're all killed, and Russians will not allow them out.
Hmm. So let's move now to the other part of the battle, which obviously is Pokrovsk. But right next to Pokrovsk are two very important towns. There's Mirnorod and Rodinsky. And both of those apparently have been overtaken by the Russians, and the Russians now control those two, although they don't control Pokrovsk. Let's look at the map one more time, and you'll be able to see.
Actually, they do.
They do.
Yes, Pokrovsk have been essentially liberated, and this bottleneck between Radinskaya and Pokrovsk itself is closed now. The situation there is very similar to Kupiansk. You cannot get out, period. Hmm. You may try, but you're either going to be taken POW or you're going to be killed. So there is no way. And as a result, some of the forces are running into Mirnograd, trying to survive. And the desperation, again, this situation with those insertion of the special forces on the Black Hawks, you know, all of them killed, primarily taken prisoners of war. So it just tells you everything what you need to know about the situation. But it actually mirrors what we saw in Kupiansk. It's just that the grouping itself there, Pokrovsk Mirnograd grouping, is larger. We know that there are at least 10,000 armed forces of Ukraine trapped there. And again,
in Pokrovsk. 10,000.
Yeah.
10,000 Ukrainians are trapped right now in Pokrovsk.
Yep. In Pokrovsk, in that area. Pokrovsk itself is being now mopped up. They are primarily concentrating in the what is called Mirnograd. And it's pretty much the same scenario. It's cauldron after cauldron. It's cauldron within the cauldron and things of this nature. Yesterday's map, which probably was from November 1, it already shows practically full control of Pokrovsk.
November 3rd, actually, to be exact.
And inside Pokrovsk, and yes, it's it was done by my friends and Colonel Popov, for example, who follows it very closely based on the Russian Defense Ministry, essentially updates. And you can see yourself that, and this is on record by Russian commanders and soldiers, that, they hide behind, civilians. So they run into the civilian house.
So just to be clear, I want you on the record on this. Despite the fact what we're being told by the West and even by the Institute for War and Deep State and all these other maps that I look at every day, and I know that they're basically pro-Ukraine, but still, they're the closest thing we have for amateurs like me to be able to keep up with what's going on in the battle. According to all those sources, Pokrovsk is not yet been taken by the Russians. You're saying, yes, the Russians control Pokrovsk.
It's mopping up. That's what it's called, Zachistka. This is what is happening, mopping up. And they play, well, first, Institute for the Study of War, they don't study war. They're a bunch of amateurs from this Kagan, Victoria Nuland clan. They have General Keane and other American generals, which became a meme. They never have been right for once. They are living in the delusion. First, the guy who runs there, whatever, the Kagan, another yet Kagan relative, he has no background in military. None of them do. Yeah. American generals don't have the real background in real war. They never fought one. So, and when you look at this, so the only thing they do, they also scour internet. And guess what? I was talking to Brandon Weikert about a week ago, no, more than a week, about 10 days. And Brandon himself, former congressional staffer, and he was liaison between his Congress and Pentagon. He was part of the Pentagon war games. And we went on record and he said, I can confirm, which I have been on record too, that most intel which Pentagon gets is from Kyiv. So that tells you everything you need to know about the professional level of the American officer corps, which obviously is not competent because they do not know how to develop the information and how to sort out what is BS from the actual situation. As the result, you have those people living in the alternative universe, and they really believe what Zelensky and Nazi regime, apart from the fact American military and United States stained itself, which will not be washed off by supporting Nazi regime. Now everybody says, oh, there are Nazis there. Yes. There are Nazis there. Zelensky is apart from British support Nazis. They support the most Russophobic, racist, and, you know, forces there. And so now when everybody comes up on, you know, who is from the establishment and try to basically talk about something, most of them, they don't understand what is happening. Many of them are in panic. And many of them are desperate, and you know what? They are sore losers. Look at Kellogg.
So let me ask you, if this is where we are right now, and you're right, by the way, and you're not the only person who's ever told me this. I've talked to many other people who have told me that all of these map makers and all these institutes like Deep State, et cetera, are always at least 3 or 4, sometimes 5 days to a week behind what's really happening there. So I've known before that they're way, way behind. I don't know about them having this bias that you're describing, but it doesn't surprise me to hear you say that they have this bias. But let's move forward then. Let's suppose that's the situation. Andre, what happens now? If they're in this mop-up and they're done with the mop-up eventually, let's say next week, 2 weeks from now, whenever they're done with the mop-up, and then they move and they're done in Minarod and they're done in Radinsky and some of those other cities around there, what's the next step for the Russian army if the other side doesn't come up with some kind of truce that the Russians can agree with? Do they just keep on going to Kyiv?
There will be no truce. There will be taking of the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk agglomeration, which is the next target.
Kramatorsk.
After that.
Okay.
Yeah, Slavyansk-Kramatorsk. It's the last.
And I think, hold on, I think we have that on the map. Do we have that as Kramatorsk? Yeah, it's right above, right there where you see Liman, right? That's where Kramatorsk is.
That's the remnant of the Donetsk Oblast now. It's not really a republic. And then, of course, clearing up of Zaporozhye and operation of taking Kherson essentially is in the on the slow burn kind of mode right now. So the whole front line is moving. And Mr. Medvedev, he pretty much spoke about it openly a couple days ago in one of his tweets when he stated, yeah, the more it continues, the more territory Russia will get.
Yes.
Simple as that. And so, I mean, who am I to contradict him? He is the deputy or chair of the Russia Security Council.
I know him essentially well.
Second man in Russia. After Mr. Putin.
Medinsky?
No, Medvedev. Medinsky,
oh,
no.
I thought you said Medvedev. I thought you said Medinsky.
No, Mr. Medvedev.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so if that's the case, do you foresee Odessa perhaps coming into play?
Yeah, I will answer this question on a number. Of course, it might come down that political process and collapse of the Zelensky regime may resolve the issue automatically, you know, by who knows what is going on in Odessa. Clearly, we don't know. I don't know. I'm not privy to the mood on the streets of Odessa. I know there is a lot of activity of all those suppressive organs like SBU and all kinds of people of this nature. Yeah. But even eventually, you can start the political process. Russians do not need Odessa immediately right now. You know, there is a lot to digest, so to speak, from the new territories. But eventually, Ukraine, whatever will be left of it, will be exist in some term for kind of form or shape as a confederation, possibly. You know, and eventually Odessa may return back home the same way as four republics returned, or who knows? We don't know. Mr. Gerasimov may say, "Oh, okay, so we broke the back, which already happened, of them. Let's kind of go and take it." You know, so either way is possible.
Let me ask you this question. Do you see this thing lasting into the summer of next year? And if so, do you see it ending, if it ends, politically or militarily?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. Do not forget, many people still miss the main point of this. This is not about Ukraine anymore. It stopped being about Ukraine on the April. First decade of April of 2022, after the failure of the Istanbul talks. This is when Russians understood that, it's about Russia and combined West. And there are people, obviously, there who are very experienced, very well educated, very well informed in all kinds of the Russian, what would be called the strategic analysis and forecast community. And it ranges from foreign ministry to obviously general staff to SVR, and who know what is going on in the West. They do have a very good forecasting capability. So, and they act accordingly. So yeah, if it goes to through 2026, Russians can do it for a long time. But in the end, and this is already beginning to manifest itself in the most dramatic manner, it's all about demilitarizing the West. Europe has been utterly demilitarized. Yeah. United States is on the brink of demilitarization. And I'm on record since 2017. United States was the arms race. Now, it's not just lost the arms race, it's lost it by a knockout. It's not even in the same league. And fact is, United States never could really conduct proper combined arms operation of scale. That is why they are still grasping constantly to this, you know, Gulf War 1.0. It's just becoming nauseating. I mean, beating the, you know what, third-rate semi-literate Arab military, and oh my God, we're so good. No, you're not. So, and that's the thing which I had to, at some point of time this year, said, you know, enough of this corporate, you know, solidarity thing. Let's call the spade, and that's what it is. They are in a state of shock in Pentagon, in CIA, because they don't understand what is happening, because they don't have reference points. They are not educated militarily to this point of view. And it's not only about because of the, there was a primarily counterinsurgency, which is nothing more than police operations of the high intensity. It's just because United States simply doesn't have resources together with NATO to conduct that type of operations.
Yeah, it seems you're right. There's certainly not enough force behind NATO. The weaponry that Russia has, the strategy militarily that Russia has formed. And when you look at this latest rocket that is nuclear propelled that Russia unveiled a few weeks ago, I can see why the West would look at something like that and say, you know what, maybe we ought to back off this thing a little bit. These guys have a hell of a lot more firepower than we thought they had. Do you think that's in the mindset that's taking place in places like London and Washington?
Well, some people, certainly, it's not that the Pentagon are completely, or CIA completely incompetent. There are still some people who have brains left, and they understand the implications and ramifications which have been demonstrated to them. Keep in mind, and I can say it, you can quote me on that, operationally, Pentagon, operationally, in operational planning level, they are not even in the same league with general staff. First, United States doesn't have general staff. It has the commands, which do their own planning, and then Joint Chiefs of Staff try to coordinate it. None of them, Joint Chiefs of Staff, has operational control over the troops. Russian General Staff actually commands, has operational control over the Russian armed forces. So this is a completely different paradigm. They cannot fit their experiences with that. And so as the result, I mean, some of them understand what is happening. They see their, again, listen, just to give you an example, when you have the chief, former deputy chief of the general staff of Ukraine coming on the record about a couple of weeks ago, said, oh yeah, Patriots, they had 34%, which is debatable, and now they're 6% effective. Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't we see what Iran did to Israel? And Iran was using their, you know, two generations or, you know what, backward ballistic missiles, most of them. And all this wanted NATO air defense was completely humiliated. And so then you see what is happening. They cannot intercept a thing.
Well, how big is the Budivezhnik missile to you? I mean, I was shocked when I saw the unveiling of it. I thought, what the hell? Look at that thing. It could be up in the air for 14 hours, maybe indefinitely. Is that true?
Well, yeah. Vladimir Putin yesterday, no, 2 days ago on the 4th, he already stated, it's supersonic, it's capable of low supersonic flight. Now, the next generation of Burevestnik, which already exists, will be a Mach 3+, supersonic and hypersonic versions go in, but it's not even Burevestnik itself. Listen, since 2018, when they called it, you know, Putin's cartoons and things like that, all practically all of those weapons, you know, including hypersonic technology, have been in combat use range. So, and Burevestnik is not just the fact that it can be there indefinitely, which it looks like, it's the fact of this miniaturization of the nuclear reactors. We don't even know. Anybody who tells you, oh, I know how it works, tell them just go pound sand. They don't, okay? There are a lot of speculations, but, you know. And so the issue here is that, oh, for some reason, something moved here.
Yeah, you're good.
And, the reason being that it's the miniaturization of these nuclear reactors, which allows now, and obviously this technology, it's not, you know, 100% copy. But what Vladimir Putin stated, I quote the boss, that lunar stations and then flight to Mars on the new type of the propulsion, which going to accelerate you to the essentially, well, so in not insignificant fraction of the speed of light, 600, 1,000 kilometers per second. That means one thing. Deep solar system, you know what, a flight. And who knows, mining things and Russians and Chinese signed the agreement to for the base on the moon, you know. So, but yeah, let those people who own Teslas and enjoy Elon Musk believe in all those fairy tales. So what can I say?
Well, I'll tell you what a great conversation. The takeaway is that that we learned from you something nobody else has been willing to say, at least not on the record. When it comes to Pokrovsk, it's over. The Russians control it. Now all that's left is a mop-up operation. As far as the war itself, it's over as well. It's just a matter of time and a matter of figuring out how much land or how much territory will be given up.
Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much, sir. Andre, you are just a delight to talk to. You've got a great personality. You're kind of nerdy smart, and I like that about you. So I look forward to having a conversation with you once again, maybe a cup of coffee or two.
Thank you, Rick.
Take care, my friend. Well, thousands of you have been commenting on what we have been talking about in our program yesterday, as well as parts of today as well. We're going to start with Brother Gramps, who says, love Chris Hedges. He was on yesterday. And my favorite quote from Chris Hedges, he says, is, fascism is always the bastard child of a bankrupt liberalism. Very fitting for the discussion, he says. I'm glad I'm following this channel now. We thank you as well. Mark Kelly says, thank you, Rick, for highlighting war crimes by civilians, or pardon me, on civilians, by Ukrainian drone attacks. This needs to be seen and prepared for prosecution at The Hague. Not a bad idea, sir. Paco Santini says, all the likes for you, my man Rick Sanchez. They told me your channel would not explode, but you've already gained 30,000 subscribers in just 2 or 3 weeks, so keep it up. You're going to beat the algorithm. Thank you, Paco. That was my dad's name. Wandering Sword says, Chris Hedges and Max Blumenthal are able to gather lots of hidden info and bring them to the public. Yes, they are the best. I agree. Jose says, excellent interview, Rick. Desde la Ciudad de México, te mando saludo y te recuerdo desde que estabas en el canal de TV en los 80s en Miami. In other words, he's saying, I'm in Mexico, love your show, and I remember in the 80s when you were in Miami, I used to watch you there as well. The Wedge says, Rick, it would be great if you can get Cenk on your show. I'm going to call him after the show and see if I can get him on. He would be a good guest, I think. Mike Morton says, CNN did you a favor, brother. They are tanking. And you have taken their demographics. Yeah, maybe. MMB506 says, here in the UK, people think Ukraine is winning. That's sad, but it's true. But Super Magnum says, you're in for a shock when Russia loses. That's what Super Magnum thinks, and we thank him for his thoughts. Finally, G. Manzi says, look, I won't miss words. I'm British, and during the last 5 years, from being somewhat of a royalist, admirer of the skills of MI6 and SAS, and proud of having the biggest ever global empire, my mindset has completely changed. I've seen what our government is supporting, neo-Nazis, Islamic radical groups, and the enormous role that we're playing in the Gaza genocide. We thank you, Manzio, for coming around. By the way, we do love to hear from you, and we'd love to get more and more of your thoughts. So do me a favor, go to our YouTube channel. It's called Journalistically Speaking with Rick Sanchez. And let us know there what you like or what you don't like. Tell me the truth. It's okay. You can disagree with me. We're also on X or Twitter at Rick Sanchez TV, and we're constantly engaging and having very long conversations with you there. So, hey, great show. Thanks for being here. Thanks for sharing your home with us. And we'll be looking for you next time. Adios.